Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So we're sitting here in the church. I'm with Dr. Miranda Kaufman. And, the fact is we've got a sensitive issue to deal with here. It's sensitive in terms of language. Hi, by the way.
Hello.
Hello. We'll reveal now that the subject is the history of black people in London. And I'm aware, even by saying the word black, that an American listener right now might feel uncomfortable with that terminology. African-American is the conventional term, I think, for a person of colour in the US. But we're going to be using historically accurate but offensive, potentially, language here. What's the normal way that you find yourself dealing with these sort of issues in terms of describing colour?
Well, quite often I suppose I find myself making inverted comma signals while giving a talk around, because, you know, I've attended debates in London, you know, between people. I mean, there's a guy who lectures on the African or black question, and he very strongly advocates calling anyone of African origin African, you know, and leaving it at that. He doesn't like the term black at all. Black, it wasn't a term used very much in the 16th century to describe Africans at all. So, I mean, I'm taking my cue from the original sources and the words that the Tudors and early Stuarts would have used at the time and the ones that they would have been familiar with. And I sort of went back to the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, and looked up, you know, when these terms were first brought into the language. And so I suppose, you know, in all the sort of 400 references to Africans in this period that I found, maybe the most common term that was used at the time was, inverted commas, blackamoor. That was the kind of most anglicised way of describing someone from Africa. I mean, the geography of the time was a bit dodgy. I mean, they also used the term Ethiop to pretty much refer to the entire continent. They also imported terms, you know, from the Spanish. So the Spanish word negro, you know, is Spanish for black, and, you know, it obviously has very negative connotations. I think a lot of offence caused to anybody is usually to do with the tone and the context in which you use a word. And I hope that if I'm just stick to the words that we used at the time, that people will understand that that's the context I'm using them in.
Okay, so there you have it. That's the longest disclaimer in history, but I hope you get the idea that we're going to be using some sensitive terms, but in a positive and hopefully sort of instructive and constructive fashion in today's episode, which comes from St. Olave's Church in the City of London.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound. You ain't never seen the light before, just a stone's throw from your front door.
Sun streaming in through the stained glass windows of St. Olave's, it depends who you are, how you pronounce it. With me here is Dr. Miranda Kaufman, who is an historian, and you research the history in particular of the black population of this country. With us also the Reverend Oliver Ross. He's the rector of St. Olave's Church. He's saying St. Olave's. And Phil Manning, the church manager here. Hello all.
Greetings.
Hello, lovely to see you.
Hello.
Thanks for having us here, Oliver. We should start with a description of where we are in town, I think.
We're on the eastern end of the city, which is very much the insurance area of the history of the city and the commerce. The church has been here since, well, first recorded at 1080. This building is 1450 and has seen the likes of Mother Goose buried here, as well as Andrew Bacon, Francis Bacon's brother, and he was a spy for Walsingham. But most notably, it's known for being the burial place and the worship place of Samuel Pepys and his wife Elizabeth.
As the listener will have detected, there is about 12 episodes worth of stuff just in what's been introduced here. I promise we're going to come back here with your permission, gentlemen, and dig into some of that other delicious stuff. We're here, though, particularly to talk about the history of black people in London. And I know, Miranda, that's your specialist area. I suppose the first question is, what's led you to look at the history of black people in the UK?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. No, well, it's a question I get asked a lot, actually.
When I interviewed Clive Bettington, who's a fascinating guy with a head full of all the knowledge in the world in relation to the Jewish East End, and he's the head of the Jewish East End Celebration Society, and he's not himself Jewish, and he mentioned that he sometimes encounters barriers put up by people of that faith who somehow see him as an outsider and aren't really willing to let him in for reasons best known to them. And I wondered if you find yourself either encountering any such barriers or maybe in fear of meeting such barriers.
I think there's always a fear, you know, that you want to be sensitive when you talk to people, because this is an ancient history. I mean, some of the issues involved are still very pertinent and really close to people's hearts. I mean, I've talked about this in various contexts at, you know, different academic conferences, but also sort of in Jamaica. And I mean, one experience that shows the kind of problem, I suppose, is so I was giving a lecture in which I mentioned an incident that took place in Gloucestershire in 1597, when an African servant called Edward Swarthy, that his surname was, you know, indicative of his skin colour as well, was actually ordered to whip a fellow servant whose name was John Guy. And I talked about that and how unusual it was, how interesting it was. And afterwards, this lady came up to me afterwards, and she had dark skin, and she said to me, I can't believe that, you know, when all we know about how many white people have whipped black people over the history of slavery, that you had to use one example when it was the other way around. And I mean, obviously, she was very passionate about that, and it seemed to hurt her personally in this. But I think she'd sort of missed the point I was trying to get at, which is that was why it was interesting to me, and it was very much in the context of knowing all of that that this was interesting. That, you know, that the situation in 16th century Gloucestershire was such that there was not a problem with a black man whipping a white man, although those are not the terms that the people at the time would have thought of it in. You know, that's why it was interesting. And that white man, John Guy, actually went on to become governor of Newfoundland.
Bombshell, what? Okay, we'll just leave that hanging, because that's amazing.
I think it's very important that we all find out about this history. You know, it shouldn't be like sectioned off or segregated in such a way. But I suppose I came to it from a love of the period as well, of the Tudor period, and looking for something different. I'd also always been interested in sort of travel, and I think I came to it first wondering what it was like to be a Tudor sailor sort of rocking up on the coast of Africa for the first time in that encounter. But then when I started looking into that, I quite quickly found this document that was issued by Elizabeth I's Privy Council in 1596, which says, you know, there are of late many Niggars and Blackamoors arrived in this realm. And I'm like, there are? Where are they? What were they doing? How did they get here? What was it like? You know, and I looked into that, and there really wasn't a lot written about it. And so I, you know, my mission began to sort of dig into the records, gather them all together, try and find out more.
Okay, so obviously the big challenge challenge here, and it interestingly perhaps ties in with what we were saying about women's roles in history, is that it's sort of undocumented. The portraits are largely of the men, the very influential figures at the front end of things, and presumably you must have encountered a difficulty in there being a lack of documentation, a paucity of records.
Well, I managed to find about 400, but but I suppose the paucity is perhaps in the detail sometimes, rather than that there isn't there. It is a bit of needle in haystack work, but it is there. So I found records of Africans here in the 16th and 17th century in parish registers of births, you know, of baptisms, burials, the odd marriage, but I also found them in household accounts, tax returns, court records, letters, diaries, church wardens' accounts, you know, pretty much any and all documentation of people living in the time. You know, if you scour it, you know, enough, it'll follow the odd hint, you can find something.
How do you know from the records you've just mentioned that the names that you're looking at are those of black people?
Well, it says that they are. I mean, if you're scanning a parish register, you know, some of the lines end up being longer. It's quite easy to find them. It'll say something like John a Blackamoor was buried. You know, it is difficult. There are difficulties in identifying, and perhaps there are many more who may have been of African origin, but it just doesn't say that they are. I'm stuck with where it says that they are. But there are, you know, there's a range of terms that were used at the time, which, you know, may be considered offensive today. But you know, Blackamoor, Ethiop, Negro, which was borrowed from the Spanish meaning black. But Blackamoor was the most common term from an English speaker's perspective.
I'm aware as well, of course, we're dealing with some potentially offensive terms. Were they not in a historical... They may still be offensive now, of course, and I'm well aware that American listeners might prefer the term African-American to black as well, although, strictly speaking, these are not African-Americans that we're talking about. So what's the right terminology of the time?
Well, I suppose some of them had spent a little bit of time in the Americas, but probably the Spanish Americas. But what's the correct terminology?
So should we still be talking about African Americans in this context?
I don't know. I mean, the word that was most commonly used at the time was Blackamoor. I mean, to me, that sounds so historicised that it doesn't seem... I don't know. I mean, you know, when I've spoken to people of African origin about it, I mean, there's always debates about terminology, but I don't think we should get bogged down in them.
Let's link the subject with the location then. We are underneath a statue of two fellows who are kneeling down. They're wearing red robes, and they seem to be in sort of a supplicant posture, and they're in the arches here at the church. Why have we come to look at these guys in particular?
Well, not necessarily for fashion tips. They've got some excellent ruffs around their necks, so they look like real Elizabethans. But the reason I wanted to bring you here was that one of the brothers, Paul Baining, who it says here died aged 77 in 1616, was one of the leading privateering magnates of his day, and the records show had at least five Africans in his household between 1593 and 1616.
I should explain, listener, in the background, we have the Estonian Radio Children's Choir. No connection whatsoever with anything.
This is a living church and things go on. So this interview just followed their concert and they're off again on the tour.
We should explain. We've just been talking about the statue here, and we wandered in here with this information. Were you aware of this aspect of the Bainings?
No, but it's been one of the interesting little lacunae that I've always wanted to follow up. It's pre the great and awful period of the slave trade. What was going on? Because characters appear in the back of paintings and in family groups, and they're mentioned in various different records that we have, that you've discovered, and more. I want to find out more. Tell me more.
Well, that's a pretty good invitation. Let's draw a broad landscape then of the arrival of black people in the country, particularly with a focus on London.
You know, a lot of people assume that Africans only arrived here as a consequence of the slave trade, and it's true that the first English slave trader that we know of was Sir John Hawkins, who undertook three main slaving voyages in the 1560s. But if you think about it, a successful slave trade would result in Africans arriving in the Americas, not here. So if something would have gone wrong if they end up back here, because you know, they go to Africa, they buy them there, they take them to the colonies, they sell them there, and they come home with some money or some other crops. But
now, just so I can understand the dynamics of that, does that mean then that there was no perceived market for slaves in this country to, say, do agricultural work or something of that sort?
That's correct. So, for example, in the 1540s in Southampton, an Italian man called Corsi tried to sell an African in the middle of Southampton, and nobody would take him up on it. Nobody wanted to buy him.
What was that difference in outlook about? I mean, I'm maybe naively assuming that it wasn't an ethical difference or an understanding that this was wrong. I don't know why I assume that.
I mean, looking at the way that the Englishmen sort of talked about, I mean, it seems that they had like maybe one rule at home and another rule abroad. There's this amazing encounter when an English sailor called Collins, who was stranded on the coast of New Mexico at the end of John Hawkins' third and most disastrous slave trading voyage in 1568, finds himself in a Spanish mine somewhere in the Americas and is talking to an African slave in the mine. And the African says, you know, is it true that in England there are no slaves, that you're all free men there? And he goes, yes, that's right, our country is free. And he goes, well, what about John Hawkins then? You know, and he actually knew about all of that. And that's this conversation that comes out in the Spanish Inquisition records, which is amazing.
The great dividing line seems to be the Armada. Because once the Armada's happened, money seems to flow into the church. Well, to flow into the country, but we suddenly see it in the church and the monuments. The monuments are quite strikingly different from anything that's gone before. And I just wondered if that was reflected in the slave trade, if with the defeat of the Spanish, we got more of a say across the Atlantic, and therefore people would be bringing slaves back here. And the triangular slave trade really sort of took off bit later, didn't it? I mean, but was it always triangular?
So, as far as I saw it, after John Hawkins' third voyage in 1568, the Spanish, he's actually been interloping on a Spanish market, and the Spanish decimated his fleet in 1568. He had to leave 100 of his men on the coast of New Mexico because there's enough food to take them back home again. And after that, you know, no self-respecting merchant was going to invest in a slave trading voyage because it was a bad investment. We didn't have any of our own colonies then. There was no market for slaves. So I looked into the records, and as far as I could see, I can't find any evidence of English slave trading across the Atlantic in the triangular sense until 1641, when the Star turns, a ship called the Star turns up in Barbados with a cargo of slaves. But you're right in saying that 1588 was a key year because that obviously the Spanish Armada. But the way I see it, and that is a time when the records of Africans in this country and in London, you know, really do rise in that period of the war with Spain between 1588 and 1604. But the money isn't coming from the slave trade; it's coming from privateering. So Paul Baney was a privateer. He owned a lot of privateering vessels. One of them was called the Golden Phoenix. And it actually it captured a Spanish ship February 1600, which had 125 Africans on board. But he sold them in La Margarita for pearls. That's not a kind of classic triangular trait, but it's like you capture a ship. So in the period of the war with Spain, the English were fitting out lots of privateering vessels, which a privateer is basically a legal pirate. So it's you go out there, but you have a piece of paper from the crown saying it's okay, this is an official crown thing, and you have permission to attack the Spanish because they took something off us last year. That's the sort of basic principle of it. They were called letters of marque, and hundreds of these letters of marque were issued at this period. So you go out there, but if you captured a Spanish ship at this time, the likelihood was there would be Africans on board, and so some of them, and there are various things you could have done with them. If there was a market to sell them on your travels, you might have done that. But if you didn't, they were still there, and they might end up here. In 1590, 150 Africans were brought into Bristol on a prize ship called the Charles.
I want to come back to London then, because at the moment we're still talking in terms of black people and that you're mentioning being commodities, essentially, or being viewed that way. At what point do we start to see black people living independently and not as somebody else's worker or slave or chattel?
Well, I mean, it was never legally possible to be a slave in Elizabethan London, but... So if you look at the parish registers here, you can see a couple of the Africans mentioned are referred to as so-and-so's servant, but others just aren't. They're just that you just have their name, and that's it, and we don't really know what their sort of livelihood was. But if you look a bit further afield to another parish of St. Olave across the river in Tooley Street, over there in the 1590s, there was a man who's recorded as Reasonable Blackman was his name, and he was a silk weaver. He's listed as being a silk weaver. So he was an independent businessman, craftsman who could support. He had three children, according to the parish register. And a bit earlier on, there's a reference to a man who in Cheapside who made fine Spanish needles. And refused to teach his art to any. So he had a monopoly on making the fine Spanish needles in Cheapside. So he must have been able to support a family as well.
So people potentially tied in with the rag trade. That seems to feature quite a bit with immigration in the country for a long period. And you said that was around about the 1590s. Could we get a general picture, gentlemen, of the area around here at around that time? What was the makeup of the area? What was going on here?
The historical records show a lot of merchants' houses in this area. In fact, opposite St. Olave's here, in what is now Hart Street, there was a house called Whittington's Palace, not thought to be something to do with Dick Whittington, but a very substantial courtyarded house, and that was not isolated. Francis Walsingham, Elizabeth's spymaster, lived in this area, and just the character of the monuments we have here, the number of merchant adventurers we have on our walls is quite striking.
And is it just the geographic location that we're close to where they would have set off?
Yes, it is. This was particularly a trading area, so we got in a lot of people who were seeking sanctuary. There were the sort of Huguenots, and there were those Protestant Dutch, and also Jews sort of moved into this area as well. And they possibly helped with Walsingham's information network. But we had merchants who went all over the place, including James Dean, who is another large monument here. And he was involved with the West Indies. And you have something to say about James Dean.
I don't have anything to say about James Dean. He shouldn't have driven so fast. But one sentence backwards, you were talking about the Jewish population here, and that was something else I came across in my research, is that so in this church there was they weren't allowed to be called Jewish, and they, you know, were involved in the parish as well because they were conversos, you know, they had converted supposedly to Christianity because you weren't allowed to be Jewish here at that time. But there, you know, what we would have considered Jewish, there were at least three Jewish households in this parish that I know had African servants in them. These Jews had mostly originated in Portugal, but then they were expelled from Portugal. Then they moved to the Netherlands, actually, and mostly Antwerp. But then Charles V expelled the Jews from Antwerp in 1549, at which point we know that Hector Nunez came here, and so did shortly after, probably his brother-in-law, Francisco Alvarez, as well as a Mr. Francis Pinto, all three of which lived in this parish. And I know Nunez and Pinto were buried here as well, and their servants. So there was a blackamoor girl, she was described as a blackamoor girl, buried here in 1611, I think, from Mr. Pinto's. And Hector Nunez had two female African maids who were also buried here in 1588 and 1590. And we also know of other Africans in his household.
So in your research, have you come across any accounts of what people thought of seeing a black person? I'm imagining it must have been quite an unusual thing to see a black person perhaps walking down the street. Is there any record of what people made of that experience?
I wish there were. I really do. I haven't found any kind of first-person accounts of wow, I saw this thing today, you know, like that shows another potential route, because we don't always think of it, but there was actually a substantial black population in contemporary Europe at the time. So there was a sort of 10% of the population of Lisbon at this time was black. So if these Portuguese Jews had come here from Portugal, it's possible that they'd actually, either these Africans in the household had come with them at the time or later through their kind of trade contacts. And you know, again, with Antwerp, I mean, you know, the Netherlands was part of the Spanish Habsburg Empire at that time, and there was also black population there. So, you know, it's possible that these particular Africans, privateering was one way, but another way was coming from Europe.
So it almost seems surprising that we didn't have a much larger black population then.
Well, maybe we did, but they weren't written down.
Ah, okay.
But going on to... So we don't have any, you know, juicy diary tidbits of... You know, I mean, when the only time I found an African sort of really mentioned in a diary, it just says, I took Anthony from Guinea to be my servant today. You know, that's that's pretty much it. that's somebody called Throckmorton. I think Arthur Throckmorton, Raleigh's brother-in-law, right. Bess Throckmorton's brother. His diary's at Canterbury Cathedral Archives now.
Nicholas Throckmorton's buried over in St Catherine Cree, just across the way. And he was the king's butler. Well, the queen's butler, actually. Was brother-in-law to Walter Raleigh.
Father-in-law to Walter Raleigh.
So this was the brother. So, yeah, it's a very small world. All of these people were interconnected. And, yeah, obviously there were Africans at court at various points in the Tudor period as well.
What about if we go a little bit later? I mean, if there's anybody we'd expect to fill in the detail on this sort of thing, it would be Pepys, who, of course, has connections all around this area. Has he anything to say on the subject?
Pretty sure that at one point he took on a black woman called Nan to be his cook. To be a maid who did some... Apparently she was an okay cook. But I haven't... That sort of strayed slightly beyond like the period that I was looking at. But I was going to say that although we don't know kind of that kind of instant reaction of what it was like seeing someone walking down the street, what we can do is look at the court records, and there's evidence of how they were treated insofar as... there's this interesting story. So Hector Nunez, the Portuguese Jewish physician I was talking about... In 1587, he goes to the Court of Requests and he says, I've done something really stupid. I need your help. I bought an Ethiopian Niger, he calls him, from a man called John Lax from Foy in Cornwall for £4.10. Unfortunately, now the Ethiopian refuseth to tarry and serve me, he says. And this guy has basically run away. So he says, now I've lost both my investment and my servants. So what can I do? And he says, you know, I thought that the law here was the same as it is back home in Portugal. And, you know, but now I realise I have no claim on this because, you know, this bargain that I did wasn't legally valid. So what can I do? And this is fascinating because it shows, you know, in personal way, the difference between what was going on in Portugal, where they had a series of laws set up called the, I can't pronounce the Portuguese, but basically the Ordinances of Manuel in the late 15th century, which sort of explicitly defined what being a slave was and how you would be free or what the rules were. We didn't have anything like this here. And in that absence, there was no legislation to direct it. And so, it wasn't actually possible to be a slave here.
It was a big thing. This is 30 years ago when I was studying African history. But the Portuguese got down into Africa and they got round to Mombasa. And there was a big discussion about whether the church should evangelise Africans. But, you know, were they the same as everybody else? Mm-hmm. So, and the church decided yes. Yeah. And so then it sort of... And that's the really... twisted thing is that we carried on the slave trade, but whether it was sort of picking up on the slave trade that they discovered in sort of the Indian Ocean and then just sort of began to transport into the Atlantic north and south.
Well, I think that's another really fascinating aspect of this is going back to Paul Baining again. In his will is 1616, Paul Baining leaves £10 to your equivalent back there, to John Simpson, the minister of St. Olave's Hart Street, half of which is specifically to instruct his he calls him his Negro Anthony in the Christian religion when he shall be fit to be baptized. And it's clear, I mean, there were quite a few Africans baptized in this period, and It's clear that, I think it's a really interesting aspect of the fact that this is post-Reformation. We're Protestants now, and we believe that, you know, in order to be baptized, you have to understand what you're signing up to. If you're an adult, you know, you have, and these people get those other descriptions where it's clear that these Africans, adult Africans, were being educated. They were being taught English, and they were being, they will say indoctrinated. They were being, but literally indoctrinated. They were being taught the doctrine. We're being taught the doctrine.
That was a grudging consent there from Oliver.
This is the word that came into my head. I don't know why. But you know, and in these descriptions, it said that they had
just above your head.
It said that they had to be desirous of being baptized. You know, so in that way, I mean, I think although you know, some people would now kind of perceive that as sort of, I don't know, a negative process, that it was kind of washing away their African heritage and their African culture and like sort of forcing them to be Christian. But at the time, you know, baptizing someone was the best thing you could possibly do for somebody, you know, because you were actually including them in your congregation and in your society.
So there was an aspect there of incorporation rather than expecting servitude.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, I mean, a lot of people in England at this time were domestic servants.
Just that whole concept of the household, not that you own people in such a way, but that they are part of your responsibility and that they work for you, you provide for them. Thomas Cromwell sort of built up a household in Austin Friars, didn't he? And it was a very considerable place of work, but also, you know, that he invited people in and supported them.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big problems that trying to look at the history of Africans in the period we're talking about is we're all so kind of blindsided by what happened next. Yeah. I mean, the trauma of what happened. I mean, the transatlantic slave trade and plantation slavery. I mean, plantation slavery has to be one of the kind of worst, if not the worst, kind of, you know, incarnations of slavery in the whole history of slavery, because, you know, some types of slavery are more benign than others. You know, there are ones where you can buy your freedom, or it's not hereditary, or, you know, you don't, or you're working in a house and not in a field. I mean, there are lots of different variations. But yeah, so what happened next, it was so awful, it was so absolutely awful, that when it's really difficult for us to imagine a time before that. Yes. And what might and see it in a different context and see what was going on there.
Phil, you have the pages of a book open in your lap. What are you looking at here?
I'm looking at the Harleian Society's transcriptions of the registers of St. Olave's between 1563 and 1700, which is a wonderful book to have so readily at hand, because it's got an index. It sets things out systematically in terms of baptisms, marriages and burials. And I'm just looking at, for example, 1590 here, and we have an entry for a burial, July the 13th, Grace, a Negro out of Dr. Hector's. Now, who's Dr. Hector? Actually, he's conveniently nearby in 1591, because he actually dies himself. And it's Mr. Dr. Hector Nunez, carried to Stepney to be buried, but paid all duties here. And then somebody's helpfully added a note that it was Hector Nunez, a Spaniard, uh-huh, who was admitted as Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, 1554. But, I mean, there are a lot of entries in the register here with foreign names, not just black people. I mean, someone described as a Negro. He's just called Francisco back in 1590. And then a few years later, there are all sorts of people.
Does the fact that they were afforded a burial here say anything about them?
Well, somebody would have had to pay for that burial. Burials were a means of income for the church. There's no specific indication that these people were buried within the walls, which was the most expensive form of burial, intramural burial. That was a greater revenue earner for the church. So one concludes that they were buried in the churchyard somewhere. This church, I think, actually had two churchyards. There was something called the New Churchyard, which was across the street, which I think maybe comes in a bit later than this. But, I mean, there are many hundreds of entries for the period recorded in this book. But lots of foreign names. There's somebody who's described, 29th of January, Anthony described as a Portugale, presumably a Portuguese, out of Genning's house. Maybe he was somebody who was staying, and he died of plague, actually, in, what year are we talking about?
1593, 1594.
Yeah, so that was a bad year for plague. Yeah. So it's a very, very cosmopolitan area, this.
And it doesn't give the causes of deaths, I noticed.
Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does. I mean, I found a random entry somewhere. Somebody died of a bruise in their back, I saw. But
there's also that extraordinary one where the chap has just found...
Fell in the street.
In the street. Yes. Somebody already docked him on the head and taken all his possessions, and he's just unknown and buried.
So would you have had to have been a baptised Christian in order to have been buried here?
Technically, yes.
And what's your guess on these Africans that were buried here?
That they've been baptised.
Well, that's very interesting.
You leave the interviewing to me.
Sorry.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/londonist and click through.
Okay, so let's bring this closer to the present time. We've been talking about the 1500s, and my understanding is that the big influx of black population, particularly to London, came with the Windrush, 1948, of course, and a lot of people coming over to work in the health service and to perform roles of a sort of a public service type level. But what happened in between? There's a huge gap going on in there between the 1590s and 1948. How can we talk about black people and their presence in London and their role in society more generally in that period?
How long have you got? But if you'd watched Danny Boyle's Olympic opening ceremony, you would have thought that the Africans only arrived in 1948, apart from the colourblind casting of a few Victorian magnates at the beginning. But, I mean, we know that by the 18th century, when Africans would have started coming here as a result, as a sort of side product of transatlantic slave and the English building up of colonies, then in the 18th century there were estimates that there were maybe, I think, 15,000 Africans in London, and they were
out of a population of... Have you got an approximation?
I really don't. Look it up. If you've got the internet and you're listening to this, you'll be able to look it up very easily what the population of London was in 1800. Anyway, they weren't all, you know, living in terrible circumstances, because in 1772, when the Somerset case, Lord Mansfield ruled on the Somerset case, where he said that it was not legal for anyone to transport an African out of England against their will. James Somerset's master had been trying to send him back to Jamaica so he could sell him there. You know, this is, you know, like feeds into something you said earlier, because obviously he couldn't sell him here. Interesting. You know, after that decision was made, there was apparently a dinner held in London where 200 black men and their ladies attended, and there was, you know, a fee to attend the dinner, and these men could afford it. So that shows that there was you know, a range of situations going on in the black population by that time.
So looking across the Atlantic then, I wonder if you've any sense of how the ongoing slave trade in America was regarded by a population here which had incorporated into itself successful independent black people.
Obviously you get the abolition movement building in the sort of latter half of the 18th century. I mean, it's not my period of expertise, but I mean, for example, in terms of you get figures like Olundia Equiano, who was born in Africa, enslaved in America, sailed around a bit with various sailors, earned enough money to buy his freedom, but then ended up in England doing lecture tours, you know, for the abolitionist movement. And I mean, he was a Christian, and he wrote his memoirs, and his very existence, you know, put that into sharp contrast, and you know, and he may have helped to change some people's minds about the whole situation.
And then we have mention of the abolition movement in Jane Austen, if I remember rightly. I forget which novel, but I'm sure it's in there. And what about in the 1800s? How did the black population of London, was it developing, or was it static, or how was that working? Because what I've got in my mind is that by the time we get to the end of the 20th century, there are areas of London which previously were identified as particularly black areas. I'm thinking especially maybe of Brixton, maybe Tottenham, those kind of areas. And even those are now beginning to diffuse, I think, and you've got a bigger, you've got a broader ethnic mix going on there. But how did it work? Were there concentrations of black population in London, or were they in and amongst everyone else? How did it work?
I mean, obviously, 1807 was the abolition of the slave trade, and then in 1833, it was the abolition of slavery in the British Empire. But obviously, there were still plenty of people coming and going. But I'm afraid it's not something I've looked into particularly, as the areas of London that the Africans were living in at that point.
Fair enough. I can see you're well off your subject area.
some historians, especially in the 60s in America, when they were looking into the question of whether slavery or racism came first, like to push everything back to Europe and go back to the Bible and, you know, stuff to do with Ham's curse, you know, that one of Noah's sons was smitten in the skin and made black because he uncovered his father's nakedness on the ark or something. And
I never knew that. That's astonishing.
Well, your churchman over there is nodding.
I have heard such things, yes.
The idea with Noah is Noah had three sons, and some of the early theology theory was that the three sons represented the three continents, because they only knew of three at the time: Europe, Africa, and Asia. And so the sons of the naughty son, his descendants must perpetually serve the descendants of the good sons. And that was a kind of justification for African slavery, you know, to enslave Africans by Europeans. But there have been historians like Winthrop Jordan who have kind of pushed that through and said, well, it was, you know, racial slavery in the America, in Virginia and in the rest of colonial America was inevitable because Europeans had always thought this way and it's always been like that. And that kind of struck me as odd when I first read it. And having done this research into this period where before the English got seriously involved in the slave trade and the colonies, I feel that it kind of is like this beacon of hope of that perhaps there was this period before where we weren't treating each other quite so badly in that context, which means it's not inevitable and it wasn't always there, and so that we have more chance of hopefully getting to a point after where we also aren't treating each other that horribly and can get on together.
Okay, so we're in the very dangerous territory then of choosing our interpretation of the Bible. And is that not the follow through on your argument?
Well,
ignore the bit about Ham is what we're going for here.
No, but you see, there's a difference between what it actually says in the Bible and what theologians or other writers have tried to gloss in later times.
You've researched this period, the early period of black people in the UK, very thoroughly, and certainly it's an area of expertise. But then where do you go with that? Is it a case of digging deeper and deeper into the records there? Do you come to a point where you've exhausted what is available to research? Do you start to widen the period of time that you're interested in? How does that work for you?
Well, I wouldn't say I've exhausted them. I mean, I haven't read every single parish register in the whole country. I did try and go for ones which I thought I'd be more likely to find stuff. So in London, in port cities facing west, you know, towards the Atlantic. But I mean, I definitely don't want to try and read all of them. But I'm hoping that in the coming years that more and more of these sources will become digitised, and then they'll be a lot easier to search. And I'm hoping that I've made a starting point where other people who are looking, maybe even looking for other things, can then like add to the growing body of knowledge on the subject. And I hope that it will provoke questions for, you know, everyone from English literature people studying plays like Othello and all the other plays of the period that have black characters in them, but also historians of slavery, historians of colonial America. And compare this information with, you know, there's other work being done into Africans living here in the long 18th century by a kind of colleague of Dr. Kathy Chater, and, you know, there'll be interesting rooms for comparison there. Ideally, I'd, you know, put it all up on a website that people could search and they could find, you know, in a parish register near you. And I mean, another area I'd be interested in looking into would be the Africans in portraits. I've reviewed the image of the black in Western art for the TLS. It's like a big compendium of all the images of Africans in Western art, really, from the sort of ancient Egypt they've got a projected future volume called The Age of Obama. But I mean, it's, I think quite a lot of work has been done, but it's been done by art historians, and it would be really interesting to be able to have an exhibition of those pictures, but to do the history behind it. So you've got your portrait, but then to look into the parish registers, to look into other records around that, and sort of say, well, who actually was that guy? I mean, in the past, a lot of these pictures have just been catalogued of saying, you know, Sir so and so with black servant, if you're lucky. Sometimes it just says Sir so and so with servant, or sometimes it just says Sir so and so with no mention of the fact that there's a whole other figure in the picture at all. So I think we want to bring those figures into the foreground.
That seems highly emblematic. What do you think of this idea, Phil, of getting the parish records online so that people, maybe even people overseas who want to look back a few dozen generations, can do so?
Well, I would cheer that as a project because information and knowledge is power, and it's amazing what you can tease out of these records just by even a cursory glance, just by the odd word that's thrown into an entry describing someone's occupation or what it was that they died of. You can look through a year and you can see how many members of that household died in the year. You could start thinking about things like epidemiology and disease. It's endlessly fascinating.
And what about the practicalities? We're looking at a hardback tome there with the information that we were referring to earlier in it. What is the prospect of getting that digitised?
For us, I think that would be difficult because as a church we don't have the resources to do this. But if somebody was running a project to digitise the parish records in England and Wales and I guess Scotland...
Are we still allowed to talk about Scotland, or are they separate thing altogether now?
We'll leave them in for the moment. Okay. That has to be a good thing. That has to be a good thing. Somebody sat down in the early years of the 20th century and transcribed our registers and formed this printed volume with indexes.
Yes, of course, this isn't the original. Of course not. This has already been transformed.
Well, I mean, the original parish records of all the city parishes are kept at the London Metropolitan Archive, which comes under the City Corporation. So you can inspect the original registers if you've got a mind to do it. But it's actually finding a way to access and search the information. I think that would be a real breakthrough if somebody could do that. I mean, at the moment, if you want to research genealogy, and we get a lot of inquiries here from people doing that, particularly in the States and Australia, as well as from England, you have to pay a premium to sites like, well, I won't name them, but you have to pay quite a hefty annual premium. And I would love to see these things open access, to be honest. Yeah, I think it's a good thing to go for. I'd absolutely support it, and we would cooperate.
I imagine a lot of people might be of a similar mind who are in a position similar to yours. I really hope that that's enabled to happen. We're turning now to what's the year you've got there?
Well, I've got the year 1616 and dipping into 1617. Although with the change of calendar, it's still noted some of the entries as 1616 because the new year didn't begin until the 25th of March, confusingly. October the 1st, Mr. Paul Baining, sometime alderman, buried in the chancel in the vault by his pew. His statue's in the church along with his brother Andrew, and it's one of the finest monuments in the church. They're there in their alderman's red robes. But actually a few lines lower down, January the 28th, 1616 / 17, so actually we're what in now would be the new year, but was still then the old year, somebody called Mark Antony, and he's described specifically as a Negro Christian.
And actually, that if you look in the baptism register, 2 days earlier, he'd been baptised. The same man.
Huh.
Mark Antony.
So does that suggest then that he was baptised when he was already dead? Is that possible?
No, 2 days earlier. So it's possible that he was baptised because he was already ill.
That's quite conceivable.
I mean, 2 days, though, that's very little time to organise a burial, isn't it? Is it possible that
burials would have happened very rapidly.
Oh, I see, okay.
Because, I mean, they were very aware of decomposition, obviously. Burials would have taken place very quickly.
Oh, I see, okay. So this is a sort of a last rites, quick conversion before the end of life.
We don't know what household he came from. It's not recorded. Sometimes those details are recorded, but in this instance, not.
I suppose, unless something disastrous happened at the baptism, it all went terribly wrong.
Well, I mean, it just occurred to me that the African that Baining mentioned in his will was called Antony, and whether that was Mark Antony, we don't know.
Well, you also wonder whether something nasty was going around the Baining household, because there are Baining servants or members of the household die earlier in 1616, and then later in 1617 there are references to servants of the household. So maybe there was... Again, this takes me back to the thing about epidemiology and using these registers possibly to study patterns of disease transmission and that sort of thing.
Did we not have a similar something similar happen in the doctor's household earlier? Didn't his servant and he pass away relatively close together?
Well, it becomes most obvious in the great plague year of 1666. You can track households through... But without searching, I couldn't say. But it does highlight how interesting these registers and how useful they are and how they do repay study.
And was 16/17, was that a year noted for disease?
Not particularly, no. In this book, you will find that entries for burials take up typically a page. When you get to the years of the Great Plague, the entries run to about 5 pages. That's 1666, but there were earlier outbreaks of plague, notably 1603-4, and some earlier years, the 1590s. Plague recurred. It was something they knew about as a phenomenon, even if they didn't understand the mechanisms of transmission.
You know, the parish registers are a brilliant resource in terms of numbers, but you know, they only give you so much detail, so it's actually... court records that can give you more detail. And you know, one of the Africans in Paul Baining's household that I hadn't mentioned was a man called Abel, who appears in the Bridewell court in the early 17th century as well, and we don't know what he was charged with, but you know, they get around, you know, you can find them in all sorts of sources once you start piecing it together.
It's tantalizing, isn't it?
Tantalizing.
Maybe could we finish off, I don't know if this is possible, Miranda, but from the period that we've been discussing black people in London, is there a figure who has stood out in your mind in any way amongst the individuals that you've come across?
Well, I suppose one we know a little bit more about, just down the road from here, it's St. Botolph's Aldgate, which also has quite a large number of references to Africans in the parish registers. We get this, you know, luckily the clerk, parish clerk there at this period, liked to write much longer entries than all the other guys. And so we have quite a good record of the baptism of Mary Phyllis of Morisco in 1597. And it says that she was the daughter of a Moroccan basket weaver. And it, you know, sort of half page of, well, yeah, a decent amount of text about her baptism. And we learned that she had been, you know, been in this country for some, I think, 10-15 years or something before she'd been baptized. So that, I mean, that's an interesting question of sort of, well, why did she choose to be baptized at that point, you know, and how had she got here and all of these kind of things. But I hypothesize it's because she'd had a change of household. So she'd previously been, I think, a servant of Mr. Barker, or possibly, but now she was in the household of a seamstress called Millicent Porter. And the only other mention there is of Millicent Porter is that she'd been up before the church authorities because they thought she might have been indulging in prostitution. So possibly she was a very, you know, the strongest converts are sometimes the ones that have turned from sin. So possibly she was, you know, had turned from sin and was encouraging her new maid to be baptized as well. But
I was very keen to demonstrate her conversion, if nothing else.
So the record, you know, says that she, like I was saying earlier, that Mary was desirous to be baptized, and you know, and that she knew her, you know, she said the articles, she repeated the articles of faith. And so it's just, you know, if she's one, I mean, like many of these characters, she's one of these characters where like you wish you knew more, but at least we know a little bit more about her.
Well, I think we've opened up a lot of cans of worms here and investigated some of them, but there's plenty more to say on all of the subjects we've touched here. Phil, you've been kind enough to invite us back at some point to... Well, I'm going to keep it under my hat what exactly we're going to talk about, because we haven't really mentioned it here, but it's a good one. So we'll be back at St. Olive's at some point not too far from now. Thank you for having had us today.
Well, thank you for coming. Thank you for your interest in this place, and you'll be very welcome.
And I just wanted to say, Oliver, congratulations, because I believe you've been doing your job now 25 years or thereabouts.
Priested 25 years ago this year, so thank you very much.
Yeah, congratulations.
It's very good to have you here, and it's extremely good to be opening up another little window into the history of the parish here.
Miranda, what about your research finally? Where can people read what you've written and find out more about you?
Well, the best place to go is my website, just mirandakaufman.com. That's got probably more than you're ever going to want to know about me on there. So,
and you're tweet happy as well, aren't you? And what's your handle?
I'm at Miranda Kaufman.
Does the church, Phil, have a website?
Yes, sanctuaryinthecity.net.
And it's well worth a look, even just to stick your nose through the door and have a look at what's going on here. Some beautiful statuary, well worth a look.
Indeed.
Well, Miranda Kaufman, Oliver Ross, Phil Manning, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so very much.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Dr. Miranda Kaufman. Thanks too to the Reverend Oliver Ross and Phil Manning. Thanks too to Bernie Barclay. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.